Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop what
you're doing. Here's something for the things that surprised me not one bit file. This is from a couple of days ago, and it was actually broken by, I hate to say it, but it's true, Fox News a couple of days before that. This is from the Associated Press. Radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki lunched at the Pentagon as part of a program to reach out to moderate Muslims in the months after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, a military official said Thursday. The U.S.-born al-Qaeda operative, there's a word missing in that sentence, the word is alleged, is now on a U.S. kill or capture list. U.S. investigators say emails link al-Awlaki to the Army psychiatrist accused of last year's killings at Fort Hood, Texas. They also say that he helped prepare Nigerian Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, accused in the Christmas airline bombing attempt, and that he had links to the failed Times Square bombing. Anytime you talk about links or ties or connections, you're dealing with something that is below the threshold of evidence, in my opinion. So why don't they indict him? He's a U.S. citizen. He's living abroad. You can indict him in absentia. You can try him in absentia, rather than simply putting his name on an executive hit list. Marine Corps Colonel Dave Lapan, a Pentagon spokesman, said al-Awlaki was invited to the Department of Defense's headquarters after 9/11 as a part of a broader effort under then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to establish better ties with the Muslim community. Al-Awlaki's Pentagon lunch was first reported by Fox News, which cited FBI sources and documents. The 9/11 Commission reported that al-Awlaki was interviewed at least four times in 2 weeks following the September 11 attacks about his dealings with three of the hijackers aboard the flight that slammed into the Pentagon, but it said it didn't know enough about al-Awlaki's relationship with the hijackers to say whether he was aware of the plot. The report also said that he had been investigated by the FBI in 1999 and 2000 for having been contacted by a possible procurement agent for Osama bin Laden and for his connections to extremist fundraising groups. None of the investigations led to criminal charges against him. Born in New Mexico, al-Awlaki at first served primarily as an inspiration for would-be militant fighters, but intelligence agents said he later took on an operational role, prompting the Obama administration to add him to the government's list of wanted terror suspects. He's now thought to be hiding in Yemen. So you're dealing here with somebody who may or may not be a bad guy. It's certainly somewhat flagrant that he would be associated with these people who were purportedly involved in 9/11. But the fact that he got a clean bill of health sufficient to attend this post-9/11 meeting at the Pentagon is one of an ever-accumulating number of things that suggest that the official story of 9/11 is a tissue of mendacities. We're not being told the truth about that event, how it came about, who is responsible. I am a persuadable skeptic about pretty much any alternate theory of what happened on 9/11, short of alien intervention or some kind of extra-dimensional incursion. But one thing I know for certain sure, as some of my friends used to say, we're not being told the truth about the official story. The official story is not what happened on that day. The very least that one can say, to the point of a moral certainty, is that the government, if the larger narrative that we are told explains what happened on the day is true to any extent, the government permitted it to happen. I actually interviewed not one, but four FBI counterterrorism investigators who had spent the weeks leading up to 9/11 trying to get their superiors to investigate in detail and act on leads that they had obtained regarding the role played by the purported hijackers. Now, that's one of the reasons why I believe that there was some role played by the patsies or cat's paws or however you want to describe the people who were involved in the hijacking plot. So I'm sort of an outlier as far as the 9/11 truth movement is concerned to that extent, because of the conversations I had with people who are desperately trying to interdict what those people did. That being said, as far as I'm concerned, the rest of it's up for grabs. The rest of it's on the table because we're being lied to about what happened. And that's not the behavior of people whose involvement in this tragedy was that of being on the receiving end of something that completely took them by surprise. There's more to that story than we've learned. And most likely, if you're old enough to be listening to this program, your eyes will have closed in well-earned slumber and you will have gone on to your award long before we'll find out, or before the world will find out what happened. That is, assuming that Jesus tarries and the earth continues to revolve around the sun. Here's a story that is perfectly infuriating, but once again, not terribly surprising. It was published yesterday by truthout.org, truth-out.org. Veteran suicides outnumber U.S. military deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now think about that for just a second here. Of all the evil, contemptible gifts that the enemy of all that is good and holy has inflicted upon humankind, war really has to be considered his masterpiece. It is the demonic gift that keeps on giving. Long after a given war has ended and the banners have been furled and the troops have been withdrawn from the field of battle, the consequences of war continue to radiate onward generation after generation. And one of the things that we are learning here in the course of this perfectly avoidable and entirely criminal undertaking that is the Iraq and Afghan war, I guess you'd have to consider them to be part of the same conflict, is that irrespective of what happens on the battlefield in terms of the immediate body count, you just cannot escape the large-scale consequences of a war of choice. War, even when it's a necessity, and there are times when war is a necessity, and the only war that's worth fighting, quite frankly, is one where you have your back to your family and your face to the enemy on your own soil. And we haven't fought a war like that in living memory. And we probably are not going to be fighting a war like that that involves a foreign invasion. I can see circumstances in which we would have a domestic conflict of that description. But even when war is unavoidable and tragically necessary, it is a scourge. It's a curse. It is a malediction. It's a satanic symphony in which all the themes performed by the enemy are woven together in a masterpiece of awfulness. And this is one really good example of that. More than 1,000 veterans in California under 35 died after returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan between 2005 and 2008. Three times as many California service members who were killed in conflict overseas, according to a recently published Bay Citizen report. Investigative journalist Aaron Glanz studied the cases of Ruben Paul Santos, Alex Lowenstein, and Elijah Warren to shed light on a growing trend among Afghanistan and Iraq veterans who have died through high-risk behavior and suicide after being discharged. In particular, veterans who returned home to California died through motorcycle and motor vehicle accidents and unintentional poisoning. In addition, veterans were 2.5 times as likely to commit suicide as Californians of the same age who had not served in the military. In the name of all that's holy, stop this. There's no reason for this to continue. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute. So what's going on in California is that, according to this report by the Bay Citizen, a reporter by the name of Aaron Glanz has found that more than 1,000 veterans under the age of 35 died after returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan between 2005 and 2008. That's three times as many California service members who were killed overseas in California. Looking at it in isolation, California, of course, is huge. It would be the sixth or seventh largest country in the world in terms of economic output. And I don't remember what the population figures would be, but it's larger than many European countries. So you're dealing here with what really should be an independent republic. California should be, Alaska should be, Puerto Rico should be, Texas should be. In a better world, they would be. But you've got a population here where among those in the military who served overseas, you've got an epidemic of high-risk behavior that betokens a drive for self-destruction. Sometimes it makes itself known through outright suicide. In other ways, in many other occasions, it's revealed in terms of self-destructive behavior that's not an overt attempt to commit suicide, but has to be looked upon as a symptom of severe disturbance in the personality. Glantz, who has reported on the Iraq and Afghanistan war since 2005, decided to focus on veterans in California because it's important to look at our own community. Santos, and he's referring here to Ruben Paul Santos, was this young man who was from a community that was literally right down the street. That's how silent this epidemic is. Santos returned from the military to his home in Daly City in 2003. He attempted to battle depression with a variety of treatments, from poetry to video games, and eventually turned to psychiatric treatment. But according to Glantz, a number of bureaucratic obstacles prevented Santos from receiving adequate treatment once he recognized that he needed health care for psychiatric trauma. Currently, veterans receive 5 years of free health care following their discharge. When Santos left the military in 2003, veterans were only eligible for 2 years of free health care, and Santos did not begin to experience symptoms until 3 years at home. Post-traumatic stress disorder and depression symptoms don't emerge right away, Glantz said. When Santos did apply for treatment at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Glantz said he got the runaround, often being transferred among therapists and having to retell his experiences in the war over and over. According to the report, Santos enrolled in a study treating veterans with PTSD 6 months before his death. After 9 weeks with the same therapist, Santos left the study while his doctor rated him as having no clinical anxiety at that time. Santos hung himself 3 months later. He finally got treatment, but it was too late, Glantz said. Ruben's death was preventable. He passed away 6 years after his return, so there were opportunities for the story to have a different ending. Now, let me stop here and point out a couple of things that are very important. The op tempo of deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan is merciless. Here in the Treasure Valley, which strides the border between Idaho and Oregon, I believe it's the 116th National Guard unit here, is getting ready to be deployed to Iraq again. That's the war that's supposedly ending. They're currently in, I believe, Mississippi, training in advance of a deployment overseas to Iraq. For many of the people who are heading to Iraq, this will be their sixth deployment since 2003. Most of these people are in the National Guard once again and in the reserves. They are part-time soldiers. At least that's how their service was sold to them by a bureaucracy that's just looking for uniform fillers and coffin stuffers and trigger pullers. Trigger pullers, uniform fillers, and coffin stuffers. These people are in their 30s. Many of them are in their 40s. They have families. They have bills to pay. They have mortgages that are going bad. They have bank accounts that are running dry. They have wives and children who need them. Their highest and most important responsibility is to their families, to the wives who need them, to the children with whom they really have obligations that transcend anything that government can dictate. And yet they're being taken out of the bosom of their family and sent overseas to occupy a country that's never harmed or threatened us. And in doing so, they're helping to immiserate a people from which threats will eventually emerge, because people who are treated the way that Iraq has been treated by our government don't forget what has been done to them. And that's, of course, a perfect way to cultivate problems, which is one of the things government always excels at. How many of these people, I ask myself, given what they've been required to do, have long-term injuries that don't show up in some kind of a medical exam that are eventually going to reveal themselves in tragedies of the sort that involved Ruben Santos? 6 years after he came back from his deployment abroad, that he hung himself, I guess that's the past perfect tense, past perfect mood of to hang. He ended up killing himself by hanging himself. How many of the people who have problems of this sort, and this, of course, is one of those I wake up screaming scenarios, how many people of this sort go into law enforcement? how many of the guardsmen and reservists who were taken overseas to be part of an army of occupation with a 360-degree battlefield are going to come back and swap out their camouflage fatigues, their battle dress uniforms, for a state trooper uniform? I've got at least one friend who fits that description, or the uniform of the local county sheriff's office or the local police department. Next thing you know, they're part of an elite counter-narcotics strike force because of their combat background, and they're the ones kicking in the doors in the middle of the night to execute no-knock warrants. Now, how many people end up becoming avoidable casualties of the war on drugs here because of the paramilitary mindset mixed with whatever psychological complications might exist in the mind of a veteran of that conflict overseas? See, this is one of the reasons why I say that any war is a tragedy that is not temporally confined within its historic niche. Now, the problems don't end because the armistice has been signed or because a peace treaty has been finalized. And the problems persist. I mean, the classic example of that, of course, was what happened in World War I. On the one hand, you had the veterans of Germany who became a revanchist movement that was susceptible to the blandishments of Adolf Hitler and his perverted collectivists because of the post-war starvation blockade imposed on Germany by the Brits and the French, who sought pretty much to make the Germans solely and uniquely responsible for a war in which there was no innocent party, and wanted Germany to pay reparations almost in perpetuity. And in order to compel them to sign that armistice, they were willing to starve the civilian population after the war. By the way, Germany, just two weeks ago today, that Germany finally paid off its last tranche of reparations for World War I. That's really an interesting little data point as well. But those who were radicalized by conflict on the front in Belgium among the German military and then went home and saw their families starving to death because of the embargo, they're the ones who became the spine of the National Socialist Party. In France, you saw the country lose an entire generation in that war. Now, those are consequences, of course, that played out in subsequent decades when the intermission was over and the war resumed in the late 1930s. You take a look at Vietnam right now. They're still dealing with the scars of a war that claimed over about 2 million of their people, in addition to the tens of thousands of Americans who were killed there. But you take a look at this ongoing ugliness in what is proving to be the longest war, the longest military engagement in American history, and you think about all the multifarious ways that the people who have been involved in this are getting thoroughly screwed up, and you think about the way that those problems are going to leverage themselves in bad domestic situations and in avoidable tragedies here in law enforcement encounters, that's a really good illustration of the fact that war is a singular curse. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in a minute. One 866-986-6397 is our call number, 866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. If you go to Pro Libertate, the blog, it's found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. At the top of that blog, the current essay, which was posted just a couple of hours ago, is entitled FBI, Bureau of Frame-Ups, Bullying and Intimidation. I would recommend that you go read that. This is a story that I referred to a couple of weeks ago. It's actually a two-part story. The first part deals with Yasir Afifi, and he's the 20-year-old community college student in Santa Clara, California, who discovered a GPS tracking unit that had been attached to the undercarriage of his car by the FBI, presumably pursuant to a FISA, that's the Federal Intelligence Security Asset, I think, what the acronym stands for. It's a type of warrant that can be obtained after the fact by a federal agency, by the FBI specifically, when they're conducting a so-called national security investigation. Mr. Afifi is a U.S. citizen born in the United States, natural-born United States citizen of Egyptian ancestry. He was approached a number of months ago by the FBI, which I refer to as the Bureau of Frame-Ups, Bullying and Intimidation. That's what FBI really stands for, not fidelity, bravery, and integrity, as far as I'm concerned. He was approached several months ago and questioned about some of his for no reason apart from the fact that he's an American citizen of Egyptian ancestry. I've been mistaken for an Egyptian. I've been mistaken for just about everything except for Swedish. When I was in Egypt, I was often mistaken for Egyptian. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite memories of my time in Cairo back in 1994 was the last couple of days I was there before catching my return flight to New York. I was in the company of a young man from Spain who was about 6'4", blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and fair-skinned. And I'm, of course, an American of Mexican ancestry, and I'm a large, stocky, dark complexion guy with brown eyes. You wouldn't look at the two of us and assume that he was the Spaniard unless, of course, you come from Europe and you know something about Iberian history, and you know that the Castilian Spanish tend to be sort of fairly complexion, fair complexioned, and of course, they would look upon me perhaps as a Moor, like Othello or somebody, but I digress. Anyhow, Mr. Afifi was approached by the FBI and more or less invited to become an informant. To his credit, he told them he didn't have time for that. He's busy going to college. And so rather than turning him to an informant, what happened, I believe, and I think that given what we know of the FBI's modus operandi, this is an entirely rational assessment. I believe rather than making him an informant, they decided to try to compromise him in some way. So they attached this device to his car. They began to shadow him everywhere he went. They conducted electronic surveillance of his communications. They even knew about his employment situation. His friend, a fellow by the name of Khaled, after the discovery of the GPS tracking device on the undercarriage of Yasser's car, posted a photograph of it online at a file-sharing site. And that brought the FBI out in force. They swarmed Afifi's home, and it was in the course of the FBI's demand that he return this GPS tracking device to them that Afifi learned that he had been under detailed and invasive surveillance by the FBI. He's not a criminal suspect. They were simply trying to find some vulnerability they could exploit in order to turn him into an informant, which is to say, into a provocateur. That's what the FBI does. The FBI is in charge of manufacturing terrorism, not interdicting terrorism. I don't know if it's always been the case that the FBI has been involved in that. Of course, during the era of COINTELPRO back in the 1960s, just about every radical group of any consequence in this country was either compromised by or run by the FBI, up to and including the major National Socialist Movement under George Lincoln Rockwell, who was, by several accounts I've read, on the payroll of the FBI as part of COINTELPRO. Well, the same thing's happening now in post-9/11. The restrictions were taken off. Whatever institutional safeguards existed that prevented abuses were dispensed with. So you have a situation where a 20-year-old kid is essentially being harassed and persecuted by the FBI in the hopes of turning him into an informant. And an informant in common practice by the FBI is somebody who's used to instigate terrorism rather than preventing it. And the reason why I say this is that you can look at something that happened just a couple of days before Mr. Afifi found this tracking device on his car. Just a couple of days earlier, the federal prosecutor in Orange County dropped a series of charges against a fellow from Afghanistan by the name of Ahmadullah Saiz Niasi, Ahmad, to his friends. He was accused of concealing ties to terrorist groups when he filled out a naturalization application to become a naturalized citizen of the United States. Now, his purported offense was to conceal the fact, I don't know if conceal is the right word, he didn't mention the fact, that his sister is married to somebody who's part of the Taliban, and at one point, in one turn of the kaleidoscope, that faction of the Taliban was distantly aligned with somebody who was purportedly affiliated with Al-Qaeda and at one time might have been involved in some distant way with Osama bin Laden. So you have a situation here that I refer to as the Spaceballs guilt by association tactic. And I don't know if you've ever seen the film Spaceballs, Mel Brooks' masterpiece of science fiction parody. The Darth Vader caricature in that film, played by Rick Moranis, who is one of my favorite comic actors, was named Dark Helmet. And in the climactic confrontation with the hero Lone Star, Dark Helmet said, "I have something to tell you before I kill you. You should know something about the two of us." And Lone Star said, "What is that?" And Darth Helmet replied, "I am your father's brother's nephew's cousin's former roommate." And Lone Star asked, "What does that make us?" And Dark Helmet said, "Well, absolutely nothing." Well, unfortunately, according to the unconstitutional but commonly practiced doctrine of corruption of blood or guilt by distant involuntary association, that type of attenuated connection is enough to establish terrorist connections or terrorist ties with somebody who is being targeted by the FBI. And on that basis, on the basis of the fact that Niasse did not mention that relationship, he was eventually charged with immigration fraud and confronted the prospect of over 30 years in prison if he were found guilty of concealing this supposed connection to terrorism. Now, that charge was dropped in late September because of the fact that it was revealed that Niazi, Amma Niazi, this Afghan Arab language teacher who was living in Orange County, California, had been targeted by an infiltrator and provocateur by the name of Craig Montille. I believe it's pronounced Montille. He called himself Farouk Aziz. Now, Mr. Montille, a.k.a. Farouk, is a career criminal. He's somebody who has a criminal record going back to 1987, includes such things as burglary and grand theft. He was approached by the FBI in 2006 and invited to become an informant, targeting the Irvine Muslim Community Center, a mosque in Irvine, California, in Orange County. He showed up, professed to be a man of mixed French-Syrian ancestry. He was actually a self-employed fitness trainer who, while he was on the FBI's payroll, managed to scam over $150,000 out of a couple of women he met at one of the health clubs he frequented. One of them wanted nothing to do with him, but yet allowed herself to be caught in some kind of weird psychic undertow this guy projects. And in the style of a victim of a Nigerian mail fraud scam, she ended up giving him increments of tens of thousands of dollars at a throw that he was supposedly going to use to invest in a human growth hormone cartel that would market illegal performance-enhancing drugs to people looking to get some kind of an edge in the field of personal training. And he led her on with promises that at some point there was going to be a huge payday where she'd be able to leverage tens of thousands of dollars into hundreds of thousands of dollars. He kept putting her off, and getting more and more money out of her. I don't know how that works, but there it is. He also approached another woman at the same time and got a similar amount out of her, and on top of that, got her to buy him a new car, and a plasma screen television, and managed to inveigle himself into her bed in spite of the fact that he was married at the time. This is the FBI's prize undercover informant who infiltrated this mosque. And after about a year of this kind of conduct, Mr. Montille began to go into phase two, which required that he pose as a jihadist. In June of 2007, he was in a car with Mr. Niazi, this young Afghan expatriate, when out of the blue and apropos of nothing, he started talking about his outrage over the war in Iraq and the attack on Muslims overseas by the United States government. And that's pretty much the recruiting pitch used by federal undercover agents and provocateurs. Once again, they don't seek to stir up Muslim wrath by talking about how infidels impudently resist the call of Muhammad. He talks about legitimate grievances having to do with the foreign policy of Washington and how it kills innocent Muslims abroad. I'll talk a little bit more about this case on the other side of the break. It's really quite a fascinating study. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be right back. kind of a guy that the FBI approaches to become one of its heroic undercover agents. Fellow's name is Craig Montilla. He called himself Farouk Aziz, posed as an Egyptian-Syrian convert to Islam, infiltrated a mosque in Irvine, California, and in June 2007, he's driving to the mosque for Friday night worship services and prayers with this fellow. I believe at the time he was 32 years old, Ahmad Niazi. He was from Afghanistan. He wanted to become an American citizen. He was making a living teaching Arabic at a local Berlitz facility. They're riding in a car together, and the FBI's undercover agent, who always had the habit, by the way, of touching his BlackBerry whenever he started a conversation because he wanted to record the conversation or at least some part of it, started talking about his outrage over the foreign policy of Washington, how they were killing innocent Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, once again, he's not talking about how impudent the infidels are, that they don't make Islam, that they don't submit to the doctrine of Muhammad. He's talking about a legitimate grievance. I mean, the government rulingist knows that what it is doing is creating terrorism. If they didn't, they wouldn't be using this as a recruiting pitch every time they're trying to find terrorists or find scapegoats or to engineer a provocation that can later on be described as terrorism. I find that tremendously revealing. In any case, this fellow Montilla, or forgive me, this fellow Niazi, the subject of this performance by the FBI's provocateur, looked at the driver and the two of them at the same time. The driver, by the way, was a fellow who was going to be delivering the sermon that night at the mosque. They gave each other a look as if to say, what's with this guy? Because suddenly he was talking about jihad. He was asking them if there was an operation that he could be part of. The two of them, the two subjects of this, the real Muslims in this conversation, went right to the FBI. They went by way of a friend of theirs who represents the Muslim community in Orange County, California, who had been on very good terms with the FBI. And they called the FBI and said, look, we've got a concern about this guy who's infiltrated the mosque. We think that he very well might have slipped a cog, or that he might do something stupid, or he might do something murderous. But I think that we have a possible terrorist. The fellow who called from CARE reported directly to J. Stephen Tidwell, who is the assistant FBI director for the Los Angeles region, telling him we may have a possible terrorist. He's a white convert in Irvine. And before he could even finish that phrase, Tidwell replied, okay, thanks for letting us know. Cut him off, hung up the phone. What he should have said was, I know, he's one of ours. But what happened, rather than mounting an investigation here, because this guy was working for the FBI, several special agents were dispatched to interview Ahmad Niazi and the fellow who was driving the car and any others who'd met with the provocateur, Montilla. And this was done for two reasons, the first of which was to find out if Montilla had been compromised to the point where he was no longer useful in this operation, and secondly, it was to find out if there were any vulnerabilities on the part of the people who had reported him to the FBI that could be used to turn them into informants and provocateurs in the place of Mr. Montilla. After this happened, the mosque gotten a restraining order on this guy. They didn't want him to be attending prayer services there. He was driving people away. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with him. They wanted to pray. They wanted to worship. They were, once again, pursuing a religion that I consider to be profoundly and incurably wrong, but they weren't seeking to create conflicts with anybody. They were simply there to worship God as they understood worship and as they understood God. Their understanding is infirm, but their intent was not malicious. So when this guy showed up starting to talk about jihad, most people gave him a wide berth, and some people stopped coming altogether. He became a real nuisance, so they got a restraining order trying to keep him away from their house of worship. This provoked the provocateur into starting to make threats against the people who had sought the restraining order. One of the people he targeted was the same Ahmad Niazi. What he said in email to Niazi was the following. There is a restraining order against me. The FBI has contacted me. They want to interview me about certain rumors. Ahmed, I have evidence of the things we discussed. I have proof and lots of proof. Now it's my turn. In other words, he was threatening to frame this guy for terrorism. A couple of months after that, Montilla was finally arrested on fraud charges, and a really generous plea bargain agreement was reached. He could have spent 5 years in prison for defrauding these two women out of 150 grand. Instead, he was given 18 months in jail, of which he served less than half, because of an intervention by the prosecutor recognizing his service to the FBI as an undercover informant. Now, this is the guy who'd actually been committing crimes against people and property. A few months later, Niazi was approached by the FBI and confronted with what I call the Randy Weaver ultimatum. Some of you might recall that Randy Weaver was framed up on a perfectly ludicrous firearms charge, and then a demand was made that he become an undercover asset for the ATF to infiltrate the Aryan nationwide supremacist outfit in northern Idaho. To his eternal credit, Randy Weaver told the ATF to inseminate itself. And as a result, he and his family were attacked. His wife was murdered. His only son was murdered. We all know how that turned out. Well, Niazi was the subject of a similar ultimatum, either become an informant or the FBI was going to press the charge of immigration fraud against him and send him to prison for up to 30 years. What happened is that this all occurred after Montilla got out of prison, and he was angry at the FBI, and so he started to collaborate with the Muslims he had once infiltrated on behalf of the FBI in putting together a $10 million lawsuit against the Bureau for what it did using him against the Muslims. Now, that's the part of the story I find really compelling here, because they were dealing with a guy who's a criminal personality to begin with. He had obvious issues that made him vulnerable and made him a liability. But he filed a number of documents, first of all, seeking for the restraining order to be taken off of his record, and secondly, to explain why he was suing the FBI, that are full of really, really fascinating disclosures about how the FBI operates. In a 28-page deposition, he talked about how he was given a quota to collect information on 10 new Muslims per day. He said that the FBI is running, through the Federal Joint Terrorism Task Force's infiltration and provocation operations in places such as New York, Dearborn, Michigan, and Orange County, Los Angeles. He could mention Chicago as well. In 2006, he was approached by the FBI to infiltrate this mosque as part of a program, quote, pursuant to a national security directive called Operation Flex, which was signed by President Bush as Executive Order Number 12356. He said that he was instructed, and I'm quoting now from his account, quote, to advance an agenda that involved organizing terrorist activities, making reference to jihad, holy war, and organizing terrorist plots and activities. At the direction of the FBI, he attempted to infiltrate and spy on the activities of the members of the Irvine Mosque in an effort to uncover potential terrorists and plots against the government. He was instructed by his handlers to act in a manner that suggested that he was a terrorist. His actions made many of the members of the mosque uncomfortable, and the attorney for the mosque, Omar Siddiqui, contacted him in an effort to get him to stop attending regular prayers. Now think about that for a second. He was instructed, and I quote now from his sworn affidavit, to advance an agenda that involved organizing terrorist activities, making reference to jihad, and organizing terrorist plots and activities. In other words, the FBI hired him to organize a terrorist plot. Not to uncover one, but to organize one. And to see if he could get anybody to join. He was hired as a terrorist organizer and recruiter. A terrorist facilitator, to use an expression that's actually been used by a federal prosecutor in the Newburgh 4 case in New York City. What this is an admission against interest that it was the FBI's implanted thug who was advancing a terrorist agenda at that mosque. The faithful Muslims who attended that mosque threw him out. And it was because they threw him out that one of them was targeted for vindictive, bogus prosecution as a way of trying to browbeat and strong-arm him into becoming a provocateur himself. Now, one commentator, one of the legal community activists who was part of this, working on behalf of the Muslims in Irvine, California, said that if half of what Mr. Montilla says is true, the Americans would come to the conclusion that some FBI agents were being trained by the KGB. You know, that's not far from the truth, because since July of 1994, the FBI and KGB have been partners, thanks to an accord that was signed in Moscow on Independence Day, 1994, by Louis Freeh, who was Bill Clinton's FBI director, that put the FBI and the KGB together as a counterterrorism partnership. I don't know which is more corrupted in that partnership, because they're both in the same dirty game. And thus it goes. Thanks for joining me this evening. Please join me online once again at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'd be advised that there is a place there by way of PayPal where you can make donations if you have the means and inclination. I'd certainly appreciate that. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. I'll be back next week. And until then, as always, Doom Spiro Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, God bless.